Across the Sea of Stars by Arthur C. Clarke. Silence, please. Continued. No, the last explanation can hardly hold. Several of them are quite as hard up as I am, and have complained with equal bitterness about Drew's no-credit rule. My only fear as I type these words on my old Remington noiseless is that John Christopher, or George Whitley, or John Bainan, are already hard at work using up the best material, such as, for instance, the story of the Fenton Silencer. I don't know when it began. One Wednesday is much like another, and it's hard to tag dates onto them. Besides, people may spend a few months lost in the white-hot crowd before you first notice their existence. That had probably happened to Harry Purvis, because when I first came aware of him, he already knew the names of most of the people in our crowd, which is more than I do these days, now that I come to think of it. But though I don't know when, I know exactly how it all started. Bert Huggins was the catalyst, or to be more accurate, his voice was. Bert's voice would catalyze anything. When he indulges in a confidential whisper, it sounds like a sergeant major drilling an entire regiment. And when he lets himself go, conversation languishes elsewhere, while we all wait for those cute little bones in the inner ear to resume their accustomed places. He had just lost his temper with John Christopher. We all do this at one time or another. And the resulting detonation had disturbed the chess game in progress at the back of the saloon bar. As usual, the two players were surrounded by backseat drivers, and we all looked up with a start as Bert's blast whammed overhead. When the echoes died away, someone said, "I wish there was a way of shutting him up." It was then that Harry Purvis replied, "There is, you know." Not recognizing the voice, I looked round. I saw a small, neatly dressed man in the late 30s. He was smoking one of those carved German pipes that always make me think of cuckoo clocks and the Black Forest. That was the only unconventional thing about him. Otherwise, he might have been a minor treasury official, all dressed up to go to a meeting of the Public Accounts Committee. "I beg your pardon," I said. He took no notice, but made some delicate adjustments to his pipe. It was then that I noticed that it wasn't, as I'd thought at first glance, an elaborate piece of wood carving. It was something much more sophisticated, a contraption of metal and plastic like a small chemical engineering plant. There were even a couple of minute valves. My God, it was a chemical engineering plant. I don't goggle any more easily than the next man, but I made no attempt to hide my curiosity. He gave me a superior smile. "All for the cause of science. It's an idea of the biophysics lab. They want to find out exactly what there is in tobacco smoke, hence these filters. You know the old argument, does smoking cause cancer of the tongue, and if so, how? The trouble is that it takes an awful lot of distillate to identify some of the obscure byproducts, so we have to do a lot of smoking. But doesn't it spoil the pleasure to have all this plumbing in the way? I don't know. You see, I'm just a volunteer. I don't smoke." "Oh," I said. For the moment, that seemed the only reply. Then I remembered how the conversation had started. "You were saying," I continued with some feeling, for there was still a slight tintiness in my left ear, "that there was some way of shutting up Bert, that we'd all like to hear it, if that isn't mixing metaphor somewhat." "I was thinking," he replied, after a couple of experimental sucks and blows, "of the ill-fated Fenton Silencer. Sad story. Yet I feel one with an interesting lesson for us all. And one day, who knows, someone may perfect it and earn the blessings of the world." Suck, bubble, bubble, plop. "Well, let's hear the story. When did it happen?" He sighed. "I'm almost sorry I mentioned it. Still, since you insist, and of course on the understanding that it doesn't go beyond these walls." "Of course." "Well, Rupert Fenton was one of our lab assistants, a very bright youngster, with a good mechanical background, but naturally not very well up in theory. He was always making gadgets in his spare time. Usually the idea was good, but as he was shaky on fundamentals, the things hardly ever worked. That didn't seem to discourage him. I think he fancied himself as a latter-day Edison, and imagined he could make his fortune from the radio tubes and other oddments lying around the lab. And his tinkering didn't interfere with his work, no one objected. Indeed, the physics demonstrators did their best to encourage him, because after all, there is something refreshing about any form of enthusiasm. But no one expected he'd ever get very far, because I don't suppose he could even integrate E to the X. Is such ignorance possible? Gasped someone. Well, maybe I exaggerate. Let's say XE to the X. Anyway, all his knowledge was entirely practical. Rule of thumb, you know. Gave him a wiring diagram, however complicated, and he could make the apparatus for you. But unless it was something really simple, like a television set, he wouldn't understand how it worked. The trouble was, he didn't realize his limitations. And that, as you'll see, was most unfortunate. I think he must have got the idea while watching the honors physics students doing some experiments in acoustics. I take it, of course, that you all understand the phenomenon of interference. Naturally, I replied. Hey, said one of the chess players, who had given up trying to concentrate on the game, probably because he was losing. I don't. Purvis looked at him as though seeing something that had no right to be around in a world that had invented penicillin. In that case, he said coldly, I suppose I'd better do some explaining. He waved aside our indignant protests. No, I insist. It's precisely those who don't understand these things who need to be told about them. If someone had only explained the theory to poor Fenton while there was still time. He looked down at the now thoroughly abashed chess player. I do not know, he began, if you have ever considered the nature of sound. Suffice to say that it consists of a series of waves moving through the air. Not, however, waves like those on the surface of the sea. Oh, dear, no. Those waves are up and down movements. Sound waves consist of alternate compressions and rarefactions. Rare what? Rarefactions. Don't you mean rarefications? I do not. I doubt if such a word exists, and if it does, it shouldn't, retorted Purvis, with the aplomb of Sir Alan Herbert dropping a particularly revolting neologism into his killing bottle. Where was I? Explaining sound, of course. When we make any sort of noise, from the faintest whisper to that concussion that went past just now, a series of pressure changes moves through the air. Have you ever watched shunting engines at work on a siding? You see a perfect example of the same kind of thing. There's a long line of good wagons all coupled together. One end gets a bang, the first two trucks move together, and then you can see the compression wave moving right along the line. Behind it, the reverse thing happens, the rarefaction. I repeat, rarefaction, as the trucks separate again. Things are simple enough when there is only one source of sound, only one set of waves. But suppose you have two wave patterns moving in the same direction. That's when interference arises, and there are lots of pretty experiments in elementary physics to demonstrate it. All we need worry about here is the fact, which I think you will all agree is perfectly obvious, that if one could get two sets of waves exactly out of step, the total result would be precisely zero. The compression pulse of one sound wave would be on top of the rarefaction of another. Net result? No change, hence no sound. To go back to my analogy of the line of wagons, it's as if you gave the last truck a jerk and a push simultaneously. Nothing at all would happen. Now, doubtless some of you will already see what I'm driving at, and will appreciate the basic principle of the Fenton silencer. Young Fenton, I imagine, argued in this manner. This world of ours, he said to himself, is too full of noise. There would be a fortune for anyone who could invent a really perfect silencer. Now, what would that imply? It didn't take him long to work out the answer. I told you he was a bright lad. There was really very little in his pilot model. It consisted of a microphone, a special amplifier, and a pair of loudspeakers. Any sound that happened to be about was picked up by the mic, amplified, and inverted, so that it was exactly out of phase with the original noise. Then it was pumped out of the speakers, the original wave and the new one canceled out, and the net result was silence. Of course, there was rather more to it than that. There had to be an arrangement to make sure that the canceling wave was just the right intensity. Otherwise, you might be worse off than when you started. But these are technical details that I won't bore you with. As many of you will recognize, it's a simple application of negative feedback. Just a moment, interrupted Eric Main. Eric, I should mention, is an electronics expert and edits some television paper or other. He's also written a radio play about spaceflight, but that's another story. Just a moment. There's something wrong here. You couldn't get silence that way. It would be impossible to arrange the phase. Purvis jammed the pipe back in his mouth. For a moment there was an ominous bubbling, and I thought of the first act of Macbeth. Then he fixed Eric with a glare. "Are you suggesting," he said frigidly, "that this story is untrue?" "Ah, well, I won't go as far as that, but..." Eric's voice trailed away as if he had been silenced himself. He pulled an old envelope out of his pocket, together with an assortment of resistors and condensers that seemed to have got entangled in his handkerchief, and began to do some figuring. That was the last we heard from him for some time. "As I was saying," continued Purvis calmly, "that's the way Fenton's silencer worked. His first model wasn't very powerful, and it couldn't deal with very high or very low notes. The result was rather odd. When it was switched on and someone tried to talk, you'd hear the two ends of the spectrum, a faint bat squeak and a kind of low rumble. But he soon got over that by using a more linear circuit. Damn it, I can't help using some technicalities. And in the later model, he was able to produce complete silence over quite a large area. Not merely an ordinary room, but a full-sized hall. Yes. Now, Fenton was not one of these secretive inventors who won't tell anyone what they're trying to do, in case their ideas are stolen. He was all too willing to talk. He discussed his ideas with the staff and with the students whenever he could get anyone to listen. It so happened that one of the first people to whom he demonstrated his improved silencer was a young art student called, I think, Kendall, who was taking physics as a subsidiary subject. Kendall was much impressed by the silencer, as well he might be. But he was not thinking, as you may have imagined, about its commercial possibilities, or the boon it would bring to the outraged ears of suffering humanity. Oh, dear, no. He had quite other ideas. Please permit me a slight digression. At college we have a flourishing musical society, which in recent years has grown in numbers to such an extent that it can now tackle the less monumental symphonies. In the year of which I speak, it was embarking on a very ambitious enterprise. It was going to produce a new opera, a work by a talented young composer whose name it would not be fair to mention, since it is now well known to you all. Let us call him Edward England. I've forgotten the title of the work, but it was one of these stark dramas of tragic love, which for some reason I've never been able to understand, are supposed to be less ridiculous with a musical accompaniment than without. No doubt a good deal depends on the music. I can still remember reading the synopsis while waiting for the curtain to go up, and to this day have never been able to decide whether the libretto was meant seriously or not. Let's see, the period was the late Victorian era, and the main characters were Sarah Stamp, the passionate postmistress, Walter Partridge, the saturnine gamekeeper, and the squire's son, whose name I forget. It's the old story of the Eternal Triangle, complicated by the villagers' resentment of change. In this case, the new telegraph system, which the local crones predict will do things to the cow's milk and cause trouble at lambing time. Ignoring the frills, it's the usual drama of operatic jealousy. The squire's son doesn't want to marry into the post office, and the gamekeeper, maddened by his rejection, plots revenge. The tragedy rises to its dreadful climax when poor Sarah, strangled with parcel tape, is found hidden in a mail bag in the dead letter department. The villagers hang Partridge from the nearest telegraph pole, much to the annoyance of the linesman. He was supposed to sing an aria while he was being hung. That is one thing I regret missing. The squire's son takes to drink, or the colonies, or both, and that's that. I'm sure you're wondering where all this is leading. Please bear with me for a moment longer. The fact is that while this synthetic jealousy was being rehearsed, the real thing was going on backstage. Fenton's friend Kendall had been spurned by the young lady who was to play Sarah Stamp. I don't think he was a particularly vindictive person, but he saw an opportunity for a unique revenge. Let us be frank and admit that college life does breed a certain irresponsibility, and in identical circumstances, how many of us would have rejected the same chance? I see the dawning comprehension on your faces. But we, the audience, had no suspicion when the overture started on that memorable day. It was a most distinguished gathering. Everyone was there, from the chancellor downwards. Deans and professors were two a penny. I never did discover how so many people had been bullied into coming. Now that I come to think of it, I can't remember what I was doing there myself. The overture died away mid-cheers, and I must admit, occasional catcalls from the more boisterous members of the audience. Perhaps I do them an injustice. They may have been the more musical ones. Then the curtain went up. The scene was the village square at Doddering Slowly, circa 1860. Enter the heroine, reading the postcards in the morning's mail. She comes across a letter addressed to the young squire and promptly bursts into song. Sarah's opening aria wasn't quite as bad as the overture, but it was grim enough. Luckily, we were to hear only the first few bars. Precisely. We need not worry about such details as how Kendall had talked the ingenious Fenton into it, if indeed the inventor realized the use to which his device was being applied. All I need say is that it was a most convincing demonstration. There was a sudden deadening blanket of silence, and Sarah Stamp just faded out like a TV program when the sound is turned off. Everyone was frozen in their seats while the singer's lips went on moving silently. Then she too realized what had happened. Her mouth opened in what would have been a piercing scream in any other circumstances, and she fled into the wings amid a shower of postcards. Thereafter, the chaos was unbelievable. For a few minutes, everyone must have thought they had lost the sense of hearing. But soon they were able to tell from the behavior of their companions that they were not alone in their deprivation. Someone in the physics department must have realized the truth fairly promptly, for soon little slips of paper were circulating among the VIPs in the front row. The vice-chancellor was rash enough to try to restore order by sign language, waving frantically to the audience from the stage. By this time I was too sick with laughter to appreciate such fine details. There was nothing for it but to get out of the hall, which we all did as quickly as we could. I think Kendall had fled. He was so overcome by the effect of the gadget that he didn't stop to switch it off. He was afraid of staying around in case he was caught and lynched. As for Fenton, alas, we shall never know his side of the story. We can only reconstruct the subsequent events from the evidence that was left. As I picture it, he must have waited until the hall was empty, and then crept in to disconnect his apparatus. We heard the explosion all over the college. "The explosion?" someone gasped. Of course. I shudder to think what a narrow escape we all had. Another dozen decibels, a few more phones, and it might have happened while the theater was still packed. Regard it, if you like, as an example of the inscrutable workings of Providence, that only the inventor was caught in the explosion. Perhaps it was as well. At least he perished in the moment of achievement, and before the dean could get at him. "Stop moralizing, man! What happened?" Well, I told you that Fenton was very weak on theory. If he'd gone into the mathematics of the silencer, he'd have found his mistake. The trouble is, you see, that one can't destroy energy. Not even when you cancel out one train of waves by another. All that happens then is that the energy you've neutralized accumulates somewhere else. It's rather like sweeping up all the dirt in a room at the cost of an unsightly pile under the carpet. When you look into the theory of the thing, you'll find that Fenton's gadget wasn't a silencer, so much as a collector of sound. All the time it was switched on, it was really absorbing sound energy. And at that concert, it was certainly going flat out. You'll understand what I mean if you've ever looked at one of Edward England's scores. On top of that, of course, there was all the noise the audience was making, or I should say was trying to make, during the resultant panic. The total amount of energy must have been terrific, and the poor silencer had to keep sucking it up. Where did it go? Well, I don't know the circuit details, probably into the condensers of the power pack. By the time Fenton started to tinker with it again, it was like a loaded bomb. The sound of his approaching footsteps was the last straw, and the overloaded apparatus could stand no more. It blew up. For a moment, no one said a word, perhaps as a token of respect for the late Mr. Fenton. Then Eric Main, who for the last 10 minutes had been muttering in the corner over his calculations, pushing his way through the ring of listeners, he held a sheet of paper thrust aggressively in front of him. "Hey," he said, "I was right all the time. The thing couldn't work. The phase and amplitude relations..." Purvis waved him away. "That's just what I've explained," he said patiently. "You should have been listening. Too bad that Fenton found out the hard way." He glanced at his watch. For some reason, he now seemed in a hurry to leave. "My goodness, time's getting on. One of these days, remind me to tell you about the extraordinary thing we saw through the new proton microscope. That's an even more remarkable story." He was halfway through the door before anyone else could challenge him. Then George Whitley recovered his breath. "Look here," he said in a perplexed voice. "How is it that we never heard about this business?" Purvis paused on the threshold, his pipe now burbling briskly as it got into its stride once more. He glanced back over his shoulder. "There was only one thing to do," he replied. "We didn't want a scandal, de mortuis nil nisi bonum, you know. Besides, in the circumstances, don't you think it was highly appropriate to, hush the whole business up? And a very good night to you all." Armaments Race. As I've remarked on previous occasions, no one has ever succeeded in pinning down Harry Purvis, prize raconteur of the White Hart, for any length of time. Of his scientific knowledge there can be no doubt, but where did he pick it up? And what justification is there for the terms of familiarity with which he speaks of so many fellows of the Royal Society? There are, it must be admitted, many who do not believe a single word he says. That, I feel, is going a little too far, as I recently remarked somewhat forcibly to Bill Temple. "You're always gunning for Harry," I said, "but you must admit that he provides entertainment, and that's more than most of us can say." "If you're being personal," retorted Bill, still rankling over the fact that some perfectly serious stories had just been returned by an American editor on the grounds that they hadn't made him laugh, "step outside and say that again." He glanced through the window, noticed that it was still snowing hard, and hastily added, "Not today, then, but maybe sometime in the winter, if we're both here on the Wednesday that catches it. Have another of your favorite shots of straight pineapple juice?" "Thanks," I said. "One day I'll ask for a gin with it, just to shake you. I think I must be the only guy in the White Hart who can take it or leave it, and leaves it." This was as far as the conversation got, because the subject of the discussion then arrived. Normally this would merely have added fuel to the controversy, but as Harry had a stranger with him, we decided to be polite little boys. "Hello, folks," said Harry. "Meet my friend Solly Bloomberg, best special effects man in Hollywood." "Let's be accurate, Harry," said Mr. Bloomberg sadly, in a voice that should have belonged to a whipped spaniel. "Not in Hollywood, out of Hollywood." Harry waved the correction aside. "All the better for you. Sol's come over here to apply his talents to the British film industry." "There is a British film industry?" said Solly anxiously. No one seemed very sure around the studio. "Sure there is. It's in a very flourishing condition, too. The government piles on an entertainment tax that drives it to bankruptcy, then keeps it alive with whacking big grants. That's the way we do things in this country. Hey, Drew, where's the visitor's book? And a double for both of us. Solly's had a terrible time. He needs a bit of building up." I cannot say that apart from his hangdog look, Mr. Bloomberg had the appearance of a man who had suffered extreme hardships. He was neatly dressed in a Hart, Schaffner & Mark suit, and the points of his shirt collar buttoned down somewhere around the middle of his chest. That was thoughtful of them, as they thus concealed something, but not enough, of his tie. I wondered what the trouble was. Not un-American activities again, I prayed. That would trigger off our pet communist, who at the moment was peaceably studying a chessboard in the corner. We all made sympathetic noises, and John said rather pointedly, "Maybe it'll help to get it off your chest. It will be such a change to hear someone else talking around here." "Don't be so modest, John," cut in Harry promptly. "I'm not tired of hearing you yet, but I doubt if Solly feels much like going through it again. Do you, old man?" "No," said Mr. Bloomberg. "You tell them." "I knew it would come to that," sighed John in my ear. "Where shall I begin?" asked Harry. "The time Lillian Ross came to interview you?" "Anywhere but there," shuddered Solly. "It really started when we were making the first Captain Zoom serial." "Captain Zoom?" said someone ominously. "Those are two very rude words in this place. Don't say you were responsible for that unspeakable rubbish." "Now, boys," put in Harry, in his best oil on troubled waters voice. "Don't be too harsh. We can't apply our own standards of criticism to everything, and people have got to earn a living. Besides, millions of kids like Captain Zoom. Surely you wouldn't want to break their little hearts. And so near Christmas, too. If they really liked Captain Zoom, I'd rather break their little necks." "Such unseasonable sentiments. I really must apologize for some of my compatriots, Solly. Let's see, what was the name of the first serial?"
"Captain Zoom and the Menace from Mars."
"Ah, yes, that's right. Incidentally, I wonder why we're always menaced by Mars. I suppose that Manuel started it.
One day we may have a big interplanetary libel action on our hands, unless we can prove that the Martians have been equally rude about us. I'm very glad to say that I never saw Menace from Mars. I did, moaned somebody in the background. I'm still trying to forget it. But we are not concerned with the story, such as it was. That was written by three men in a bar on Wilshire Boulevard. No one is sure whether the Menace came out the way it did because the scriptwriters were drunk, or whether they had to keep drunk in order to face the Menace. If that's confusing, don't bother. All that Solly was concerned with were the special effects that the director demanded. First of all, he had to build Mars. To do this, he spent half an hour with the conquest of space, and then emerged with a sketch, which the carpenters turned into an overripe orange floating in nothingness, with an improbable number of stars around it. That was easy. The Martian cities weren't so simple. You try and think of completely alien architecture that still makes sense. I doubt if it's possible. If it will work at all, someone's already used it here on Earth. What the studio finally built was vaguely Byzantine with touches of Frank Lloyd Wright. The fact that none of the doors led anywhere didn't really matter, as long as there was room enough on the sets for the swordplay and general acrobatics that the script demanded. Yes, swordplay. Here was a civilization which had atomic power, death rays, spaceships, television, and such like modern conveniences, but when it came to a fight between Captain Zoom and the evil Emperor Klug, the clock went back a couple of centuries. A lot of soldiers stood round holding deadly-looking ray guns, but they never did anything with them. Well, hardly ever. Sometimes a shower of sparks would chase Captain Zoom and singe his pants, but that was all. I suppose that as the rays couldn't very well move faster than light, he could always outrun them. Still, these ornamental ray guns gave everyone quite a few headaches. It's funny how Hollywood will spend endless trouble on some minute detail in a film which is complete rubbish. The director of Captain Zoom had a thing about ray guns. Solly designed the Mark I. That looked like a cross between a bazooka and a blunderbuss. He was quite satisfied with it, and so was the director, for about a day. And then the great man came raging into the studio, carrying a revolting creation of purple plastic with knobs and lenses and levers. "Look at this, Solly," he puffed. "Junior got it down at the supermarket. They're being given away with packets of Crunch. Collect 10 lids, you get one. Hell, they're better than ours. And they work." He pressed a lever, and a thin stream of water shot across the set and disappeared behind Captain Zoom's spaceship, where it promptly extinguished a cigarette that had no right to be burning there. An angry stagehand emerged through the airlock, saw who it was who had drenched him, and swiftly retreated, muttering things about his union. Solly examined the ray gun with annoyance, and yet with an expert's discrimination. Yes, it was certainly much more impressive than anything he'd put out. He retired into his office and promised to see what he could do about it. The Mark II had everything built into it, including a television screen. If Captain Zoom was suddenly confronted by a charging hicoderm, all he had to do was switch on the set, wait for the tubes to warm up, check the channel selector, adjust the fine tuning, touch up the focus, twiddle with the line and frame holds, and then press the trigger. He was, fortunately, a man of unbelievably swift reactions. The director was impressed, and the Mark II went into production. A slightly different model, the Mark IIA, was built for the Emperor Klug's diabolical cohorts. It would never do, of course, if both sides had the same weapon. I told you that pandemic productions were sticklers for accuracy. All went well until the first rushes, and even beyond. While the cast was acting, if you can use that word, they had to point the guns and press the triggers, as if something was really happening. The sparks and flashes, however, were put on the negative later by two men in a dark room about as well guarded as Fort Knox. They did a good job, but after a while the producer again felt twinges in his overdeveloped artistic conscience. "Solly," he said, toying with the plastic horror which had reached Johnny by courtesy of Crunch, the succulent cereal, not a burp in the barrel. "Solly, I still want a gun that does something." Solly ducked in time, so the jet went over his head and baptized a photograph of Luella Parsons. "You're not going to start shooting all over again," he wailed. "No," replied the producer, with obvious reluctance. "We'll have to use what we've got. But it looks faked somehow." He ruffled through the script on his desk, then brightened up. "Now, next week we start on episode 54, Slaves of the Slugmen. Well, the Slugmen gotta have guns, so what I'd like you to do is this." The Mark III gave Solly a lot of trouble. I haven't missed out one yet, have I?
good. Not only had it to be a completely new design, but as you'll have gathered, it had to do something. This was a challenge to Sully's ingenuity. However, if I may borrow from Professor Toynbee, it was a challenge that evoked the appropriate response. Some high-powered engineering went into the Mark III. Luckily, Sully knew an ingenious technician who'd helped him out on similar occasions before, and he was really the man behind it. "I'll say he was," said Mr. Bloomberg gloomily. The principle was to use a jet of air, produced by a small but extremely powerful electric fan, and then to spray finely divided powder into it. When the thing was adjusted correctly, it shot out a most impressive beam, and made a still more impressive noise. The actors were so scared of it that their performances became most realistic. The producer was delighted for a full 3 days. Then a dreadful doubt assailed him. This book is continued on cassette number 5.